Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello everyone, happy new year, and welcome back to another episode of Wild World Podcast. We are kind of wrapping things up here on a, well, I say mini season. It's turned out to be quite a long season of Luigi Cozzi films. We're going to try and cover a couple here, plus any sort of loose ends we've got, I guess. But first of all, let me introduce to you my co-host today, the king of podcasting. It is Rod Barnett. Hello, Rod. How are you?
I doff my crown at thee.
Thank you. I'm not worthy.
you're more than worthy. Trust me. If I'm the king, trust me. You are also one as well.
I'm somewhere down the pecking order in the royal court, or whatever. Anyway. Let's not try and follow that analogy too far. Since we last recorded an episode, you've released at least 5 other podcast episodes, I think. You're so busy.
That is not exactly true. I think I've really only released one. I think I've got another one that I'm about to release very soon. But yeah, other than that.
It's very impressive, your rate of podcasts. So you just did one. I've just started listening to it today, actually. I'm a bit behind. On Poverty Row. Horror film called the Monster Maker.
It's a nasty little piece of work. It was the first movie to actually exploit acromegalia, or you'll hear in the podcast that I'm constantly being tripped up by the number of different ways I've heard that word pronounced in various and sundry exploitation films over the years.
Yeah, nobody knows how to pronounce that.
It's theoretically possible, but no one has made it yet.
I definitely recommend people, if they haven't already heard that, listening to that. It's interesting to hear that discussion of Poverty Row, what that was, and why their films were such an entertaining yet mixed bag. It's pretty funny stuff. Nashi Cast, any new episodes on there?
We've got to schedule it, but we've got a new episode that we're planning to do here very soon. We're going to finally do another Beyond Nashi episode. The friend of ours, the one of the men who instigated my love of Paul Nashi, you know, more than 3 decades ago, Bob Sargent, has been our cohort in crime on the show over there for almost a year now. It's been great to have Bob Sargent, man who was responsible for Videos magazine back in the late 80s, actually be willing to jump on our podcast and talk all things Nashi with us. And he was very curious. He wanted to do a Beyond Nashi as well, and we let him pick the film. So here very soon, we'll be talking about a, I would say obscure, but it's not that obscure. I mean, it's had a DVD release, But we're going to be talking about Dr. Orloff in The Invisible Monster with Bob Sargent over on the NashyCast very soon. A film that, I will say this, the first time I saw saw that particular movie, I swore I'd never watch it again, and I've probably watched it 5 times since then, so... Yeah, that'll tell you my mindset in and my problems, honestly, really.
Sure. I mean, let's be honest, depending on who your audience is, if it's a film that's on your podcast, then as far as the world is concerned, it probably is obscure.
that's a good point. Although we had a very we've just finished recording our next Troy and I have recorded our next in our series of Universal Horrors on the Bloody Pit, and it's the next episode that will come out, and it's on the film Flesh and Fantasy.
Oh yes,
that is really, it's a standout film because it's really an A-list film. I mean, any movie with Edward G. Robinson, Charles Boyer, Barbara Stanwyck, you know, and a budget in excess of, you know, $1 million. I mean, well, maybe not in excess, but I mean, they spent $250,000 just to advertise this particular movie back when it came out. So think about that.
Yeah.
So it's a fantastic film. And then of course we're about to sit down and record when, it's announced by Vinegar Syndrome that they have acquired it and are going to be releasing it at the end of January on Blu-ray.
That was a surprise. I mean, one, you can imagine how many people potentially would be disappointed picking up a film from Vinegar Syndrome called Flesh and Fantasy and then putting it on and discovering it's a 1940s black and white Universal film.
Well, hopefully the people who would be disappointed by such cinema would steer away from it in the first place, because I'm hoping that
I've never seen it, but it's one I'd like to catch.
It's an anthology film and it's highly recommended. The three different stories with a wraparound story with Robert Benchley doing the kind of wraparound story, and it is very entertaining. It is, you know, as with all anthology films, some segments are better than others, but and there was going to be a fourth segment that was filmed and then dropped and turned into a feature length film a year later, which is a story in and of itself. We get into that in the podcast.
Good.
Yeah, it's an impressive film. It's a very good film, and it's one of those that has been sorely mistreated by Universal, which is one of the reasons why it's such a. So we're very happy Vinegar Syndrome decided to pick it up and release it, but it's also one of those things where you're just wondering why in hell has Universal decided that it was a good idea to shop this one out.
Yeah, it's odd, isn't
it?
So there you go. This is. Such mysteries are podcast made or something.
Very true.
I don't know what I'm trying to say there. But anyway, speaking of, that's all really good. So obviously we'll look forward to that one. The only, there's one piece of news I wanted to mention, which is nothing to do with my own podcasting. But I just wanted to mention in terms of interesting Blu-ray announcements. I don't know whether I mentioned this before or not, but there is a new company in the UK called Treasured Films.
Hmm.
Who have set themselves up as a new boutique label. I mean, I'm always amazed when I see new labels appearing, because you just think, like, I don't know how they all survive. But anyway, there's a new boutique label that's popped up called Treasured Films, and their first film that they're releasing is The Last Hunter, the Antonio Margheriti film.
Oh, now, yeah, okay. I wasn't aware it was a new label, but I am aware of this new disc of The Last Hunter coming out, yeah.
One of Margheriti's Vietnam Rambo type films, starring David Warbeck. But although it's funny that, like, this is a new label, and it's a really interesting film to launch with. Because again, speaking of obscure, I'd say this is pretty obscure.
Well, that's just it, though. It's already had a Blu-ray release over here.
Oh, that's true.
But I'm always up for
it's a UK thing.
And I'm always up for something because it looks like. If memory serves, they have a raft of decent extras on it, if I remember.
Well, yeah. So that's what I was going to mention. So, I mean, in the UK, the film is probably best known by people who are into this sort of thing, because it ended up on a video nasty list back in the 80s.
Wow. Not a lot of those macaroni combat films really ended up there, I thought.
The British conservatives of the 1980s were... a funny bunch, but But yeah, but so they're a new label, but if you look at their list of extras, you would assume they've been around for ages because it's kind of familiar names. Okay. Let's say there's an audio commentary from Nathaniel Thompson, Troy Howarth, and Eugenio Ercolani.
Oh, cool.
Who between the three of them have pretty much got cult Italian Blu-ray releases sewed up. So it's funny that he's managed to get all three names in the same one. But there's a load of new extras on there as well, which I think Eugenio has produced because he's always good at that stuff. But what's also interesting for me, and this is how I found out about this in the first place, is they are putting on here the first UK-friendly version of the documentary The Outsider, Il Cinema di Antonio Margheriti, yeah. Which was the documentary made about 10 years ago by Eduardo Margheriti. And this previously has only been commercially available on a German Blu-ray and I believe a Japanese Blu-ray. So this is the first time that it will be available with English subtitles. So that's worth seeing. I reviewed that on my sorely neglected Antonio Margheriti blog a couple of years ago. And then about 6 months ago, maybe, the guy who's running Treasured Films just contacted me through my blog because I mentioned how this is only available in Germany and Japan and whatever. So he wanted to check with me how I knew that. So I got chatting with him and then I said, so why do you want to know? And then it turned out that it was because of this Blu-ray release. So
I would love to think that either this particular label is going to do several Margheriti films, or maybe just are they going to do a specialty line in the macaroni war films from the 80s? I mean, hey.
Yeah, who knows? It's the only one that they've announced. So I don't know what else they're going to do, but it's kind of intriguing. So this is, you can find it on their website. I think you can only buy it through them, treasuredfilms.co.uk. It's coming out in March. Apparently there are only 2,000 copies available, so it's kind of limited edition.
Yeah, probably going to have to snatch that up.
Yeah. So yeah, if you want to get it, then don't hang about. But that's quite interesting that, you know, these things are still occasionally appearing. Like we mentioned before, the 88 films I think are doing Ark of the Sun God.
Yes.
So you know, you're just constantly getting surprised by announcements from these companies. Just when you think the bottom of the barrel has been scraped, they find some more and surprise you with some of these great things.
I'm really surprised, yeah. And also these labels darting off in different directions, like Vinegar Syndrome suddenly dipping into the 40s. That's new for them in a big way. So I'm glad to see lots of these kinds of different roads being taken by these labels, because there's a lot of stuff out there, and I'm still holding out hope for, you know, the Peplum stuff and rapiers and roughs stuff that was produced in the 50s and 60s to start coming out as well, you know, anything like that.
I think we may as well mention this now. I've been waiting for an official announcement and it hasn't come, but I think we can just mention it anyway. Speaking of startup boutique companies, there's a company called Malombra Films who, some of you may have listened to the interview that I did with the founder of that company a few months ago on the podcast. And we talked on that episode about their first release called El Sesso di Angeli, or The Sex of Angels. Mm-hmm. So since then, Rod, and I'm sure he won't mind us telling you, Rod and I have actually recorded a commentary track for that film, which is going to be on the Blu-ray. And that, according to Facebook, is coming out soon. But again, you can only sort of pre-order it through Malombra. I think eventually he's going to get it onto some more mainstream platforms like Diabolic DVD and stuff. But as far as obscure cult Italian cinema goes, The Sex of Angels is kind of quite high up that list, I would say. But it's a fascinating film and one that you and I really enjoyed.
Yes.
Going into in great depth.
I think it's one that has the potential to do very well on the market. I don't know if they're pressing a certain limited number of them or marketing it. I'm not sure, but it's a very, very interesting film. So
yeah. So if any of you have not heard of that or didn't know that it was coming out on Blu-ray or whatever, anyway, look him up. I think the best way to find Malombra is currently through Facebook. So it's quite a small company getting started with their first film. but their second film is going to be a Mario Bava Western. So, you know, that's quite good news too. So, yeah, it's just funny how these things are, you know, it's never all over. Your collection will keep growing and your bank balance will keep shrinking.
Yeah, I guess we could say.
So, speaking of which, let's get on to our double bill for today. Luigi Cozzi, I think my appreciation for Lewis Coates has gone up considerably as we've done this season.
Good.
And I think in particular, as we'll get into in more detail, when I finally watched Blood on Méliès Moon, the film that he made 5 years ago, actually I think 7 years ago now, which has just been given a Blu-ray release, which again was another surprise announcement from Severin. They put out a triple bill, basically, of Blood on Méliès Moon, the film that he shot on video. Basically, it's like just a... I don't know what to call it. It's like a home movie.
It's bizarre, yeah.
Oh, it's so fun. And but then they also put on there a children's film that he made after that, which I haven't had the chance to watch yet, called The Little Wizards of Oz, which one review that I read on the IMDb says that it makes the room seem Oscar worthy. So I know I'm still quite looking forward to checking that out. But also on here, which is great, is the documentary Fantastic Cozzi, which was made by a Brazilian documentary maker. I think it was based around about 10 years ago. Luigi Cozzi went to a sci-fi festival in Brazil, and they made the documentary kind of came out of that. So that's a documentary that's been around for a while, but again, it's been quite hard to get hold of an English-friendly version. So so this release, if you're a Cozzi fan, is well worth picking up because it's got these three things on it, plus you know, he's giving introductions and there are making of videos and stuff. But I think Blood on Méliès Moon gives us some real insight into how Cozzi's mind works. But before we get there, we're going back 30-something years, about 34 years, to The Black Cat.
Fear, the most powerful instinct in the world. Fear, and a mother's need to protect her child from the ultimate face of evil. The Black Cat. Two women, one driven by love, the other driven by desire, racing into hell. A woman who will stop at nothing to get what she wants. A child trapped in a web of hideous danger as those around him are pulled down to the depths of passion, to the brink of madness, into the bowels of hell. To lie face to face with the Daughters of Darkness. From Edgar Allan Poe's classic tale of evil, 21st Century Film Corporation presents The Black Cat. Edgar Allan Poe's The Black Cat, the last word in terror.
In Fantastic Cozzi, he mentions, because originally it wasn't going to be called The Black Cat, and I suppose we could sort of start with that. He had the idea it was going to be called De Profundis, and it was going to be about sort of psychic witches and all this kind of stuff, mutants and things. But then the distributor wanted him to call it The Black Cat, and I don't know why. I mean, the Poe cycle was like in the 60s. Everything was called The Black Cat.
Oh, well, apparently from what I've read, it never came to pass, but the idea was that the producers were thinking about doing a series of films supposedly based on Edgar Allan Poe stories. And of course, this is the only one that ever came out, never got yeah, made. So
it's typical. Yeah. But of course, but right at the same time, as Cozzi mentions in the documentary, Dario Argento was making Two Evil Eyes with
George Romero. Yeah.
George Romero. And I think Dario Argento's section was also the Black Cat.
Mm-hmm.
In that, I think so. He talks in the interview about how that was a bit awkward. Dario's like, "What are you doing?"
Well, there's more than a little bit of awkwardness between him and Argento yeah. in the production of this particular movie. Yeah,
yeah. Calling it the Black Cat was not the was the least of the plagiarism issues, but yeah, the Black Cat. So we decided to end this review over Cozzi's work with this one that's like, in many ways, it plays like it's like a greatest hits of Cozzi's interests and also the sort of fantasy horror of Italian cinema. It kind of all comes to a head,
so to speak.
And it's very self-aware. They openly talk about Suspiria. It's got Caroline Munro in it again, who I think, from what he says, he tried to get Caroline Munro in pretty much every film he made since Star Crash. He kept trying to get her back, and he eventually gets her back 10 years later in this one. There's also an appearance from Michele Soavi,
mm-hmm.
so there's that kind of connection. Because in Japan, apparently, this was released as Demon 6, and so there's a sort of feel that it's connected in some way to those films as well, although not really. But it just feels like everything that happened in Italian horror in the sort of in the 80s all comes together in one
mad production.
One mad, self-aware, postmodern production on a very low budget. So what do you want to talk a little bit more about the origin of the story and the fact that obviously there's some involvement, isn't there, from quite an interesting connection to Suspiria that we could mention?
Well, yeah, the genesis of this to a large degree was Dario Nicolodi, who was kind of Dario Argento's co-conspirator in creating Suspiria and Inferno, the first two, quote-unquote, of the Three Mothers series of horror films. And she was involved in crafting this film because, of course, after the not particularly wonderful reception that Inferno got, Dario, and plus, you know, Dario Argento's rough production on that film, he contracted hepatitis, and his mentor Mario Bava came in to help him, you know, to help him complete the film and things like that. There are people who look at Inferno as kind of the point at which Argento kind of lost the plot in a way, because Inferno is
Argento never had a plot. So I don't know what you.
I don't know. I would agree. I would disagree with that with the early films. I mean, those are very tightly plotted. But the idea Inferno. I mean, it's easy to look back and see, you know, that he was ill and that the production was troubled because of that. But it did not do well financially, or at least not as well as hoped. And he kind of got ribbed, and so he darted back into the giallo genre with his next film with Tenebra.
Yeah,
and he was.
It's not like Dario was just resting his laurels during the 80s. Mm-hmm. He was so busy in that decade, wasn't he?
Extraordinarily busy and turning out some absolutely astonishing films. I mean, Tenebra, Phenomena,
producing as well as directing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he had a lot going on.
That's where we get into to where he was producing the first two Demons films and just doing all kinds of things at the time. So it was a very productive decade for him. But
and going to trying to crack America,
mm-hmm, and trying everything that he could, and then eventually in the 90s realizing that it was just not going to happen.
Yeah.
So
I mean, am I one of the only people who likes Trauma and thinks it's really good?
Oh no, I like a lot of people
Trauma. Don't like that.
I like Trauma quite a bit. I think that it's I'm actually about to do a rewatch of it. I've had the Blu-ray sitting over there for quite some time waiting for me to get in the right mindset to revisit it and really go through it. But
it's really good.
But with the Black Cat, what we have here is something that Someone named Lewis Coates. I think that may be Luigi Cozzi. Okay, I'm not going to keep that up. I do love the credits, though, giving Luigi Cozzi screenplay credit and Lewis Coates directorial credit. That I find amusing. But the idea was to finally craft a third, you know, the third of the Three Mothers stories, and that, of course, is where we get the title that he, you know, the preferred title, which is De Profundis. You know, which is the last part of the De Quincey title of Suspiria De Profundis, and
let me just get this right. So there's three mothers: the mother of sighs, mm-hmm. and that was Suspiria, right?
Right.
Is that right? And then the mother of
darkness,
darkness, which is Inferno,
mm-hmm.
and then the mother of
tears,
mother of tears, Mater Lacrimona, or mm-hmm. whatever she was called. Which, of course, eventually Dario Argento would come back to
mm-hmm. about a decade and a half after this.
Yeah. 20 years later, yeah. And I've still never seen that one, I have to confess.
Almost everyone in the world hates it except me.
Okay.
So.
All right. Well, I would probably like it then in that case. I'm open to it anyway. But yeah, so instead of, they got sick of waiting for him, so they thought, right, we'll just make one ourselves.
But then Daria, at one point or another, decided that she didn't want to have anything to do with this production and even refused to take, you know, co-screenplay credit.
Yeah.
Even though she had a big hand in it, yeah.
She sort of whispered in his ear and then backed away and left him to get into trouble on his own. And then so she's got plausible deniability.
I don't know what he's up to.
Yeah, what? He's done what?
Oh, my God.
He's making us... What? No, me, never.
I would not do... Well, at any rate. So that's how we end up with this movie. And that's why we end up with it being called The Black Cat, because, of course, that was not the title that Cozzi wanted. It was a title forced on him by the producers.
Yeah. And like he says, he just basically had to get one shot where a black cat walks across the screen.
Yeah.
And that was it.
And I think he has maybe two or three. So maybe, you know, maybe he overdid the quota just for safety's sake. I don't know.
Yes. Now it's about filmmakers mm-hmm. I think we're in Italy, although they're all speaking English. And then they decide that they're going to make the next film,
right?
Because they talk about how great Suspiria is. Oh, that's it. And the director character is talking about the three mothers, and then somebody says, hey, didn't they already make that movie? And they're like, oh yes, it was called Suspiria, it's very good.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Cozzi wanted to make absolutely sure that if Dario did actually watch this, he wouldn't take offense.
And there still is some question as to whether Dario ever did watch it, especially back in that period of time.
I mean, he might have done now. He's got a bit more time on his hands.
True. Well, especially for the last decade. But yes.
Yeah.
But the story of this basically is, to be honest, it's about a pair of couples. But the film kind of unwinds that in an odd way, and then submarines it, and then throws it up in the air, and then decides it wants a happy ending. But nevertheless, there are a pair of filmmakers. Well, the movie starts with us seeing what we think is the beginning of our movie, when it's actually the beginning of a movie being shot starring an actress named Anna, played by Florence Guerin.
And this is the movie that's called The Black Cat,
right?
I believe.
And it's being directed by Michele Soavi, who is a director I have a lot of time for. I'm a big fan of his... especially his horror films. I think he's fantastic.
Yeah. I was just watching... What did I just watch the other day that he popped up in? Oh, the... oh, dear, talking about bad films. I just watched Caligula, The Untold Story.
Oh, yes. Well, yes. I watched that about, 9 months ago. And I really enjoyed it. But believe me, I understand what you're saying.
Yes. Deary me. But yeah, but it's funny because his first film as director, which I think came a couple of years before this, mm-hmm. the Stage Fright, that also starts with a kind of film within a film,
mm-hmm.
where you think you're watching something and then the camera sort of pulls back and they're all actors. And so it's interesting that that does this here as well. They sort of pulls this switcheroo where you think you're watching a movie and then there's some terrible murders and then, you know, the camera pulls back and it's all a movie. So I don't know whether Luigi saw stage fright or whether he just, it's just coincidence, but it just reminded me of that. And the fact that Soavi's directing the film within a film makes me think it was on purpose.
Well, I love the fact that this particular cinematic fake out of, you think you're watching the beginning of the movie when it's actually, you know, a kind of production on screen. I just watched an old movie from 1931 or 33 last night called Murder at Midnight that starts the exact same way. You think you're watching, a trio of people enact a murder, and then it turns out that they're actually doing an elaborate thing that's part of a game of charades. In front of a room full of about 20 other people, and the camera pulls back, and the people start trying to guess what word they were attempting to make everyone aware of. And so it's let's put it this way, age old. If I could see it in a movie from the early 30s, then this is something that's been around for probably even longer than that. Mm-hmm. But This interesting thing we get going here is that Anna is married to Mark Ravania, who's played by Urbano Barberini, who I almost want to mispronounce and start calling him that character that John Travolta played in Welcome Back, Kotter. I have to be careful about that.
And he's a very sophisticated auteur theory type director,
right? But he's known as
cliched movie director.
Yeah, he's known as kind of the king of spaghetti horrors, which means that let's be honest, he's kind of patterned after Dario Argento. So
yeah.
but of course, this movie works. This movie exists in a world in which Dario Argento exists. And so it's really playing fast and loose with just how many people could actually hold that title sometime in the 1980s. But hey, all right.
Yeah.
Mark Ravinia and his writing partner, his screenplay partner, have been working on a new horror film about the witch Lavinia from Thomas De Quincey's essay Suspiria de Profundis. And since Dario Argento appears to be uninterested in completing his Three Mothers trilogy, I guess, because they do, as you say, they talk about Suspiria in the film.
Yeah.
Well, Anna, the director's wife, has reservations about playing such a bitch, quote unquote, but it appears that the spirit of Lavinia feels the same way.
Yes.
And anyone else purporting to show the face behind her veil. So Lavinia starts appearing to Anna as she reads the script and threatening to drive her to the brink of madness, because apparently she does the ghost of Lavinia, or the spirit of Lavinia, does not consider her worthy of bringing her image to the masses.
She's a very attractive image, it is too.
Let's talk a little bit about, before I go any further, let's talk a little bit about how my the makeup, the kind of scaly, scummy makeup that's on the flesh of the person playing the hideous Lavinia. I got to say, I'm impressed by it a lot, and I was really kind of weirded out by how impressive it was when later in the movie we get some real strong close-ups on the face, and that scaly stuff is even on the eyelids. I was like, wow, man, they went the whole nine yards on this. I was impressed.
Yeah, she's got warts on top of her warts.
Very true.
Really quite disturbing.
Not just wearing bizarre contact lenses. This is a pretty impressive makeup, pretty nasty, I gotta say.
Yeah. So there's and there's all this sort of, so I could tell you a little bit from the book that I've got here, the Luigi Cozzi book, tries to sort of summarize what's going on a little bit. Because he wanted to make a sci-fi. He's always wanting to make science fiction films, basically, and I think that was originally his plan with this. I mean, in Fantasticozzi, he tries to explain how Paganini horror is not a horror film; it's a science fiction film. So he's always trying to make it all sci-fi. Yeah. Anyway, so the story revolves around two women who have tremendous mind powers. The evil one wants to rule the world after killing her rival, while the good one is unaware of her own powers. While posing as a nanny to Guerin's child, the evil mutant builds a mental labyrinth around her. All the bad things that happen are a terrible illusion created by her rival to get rid of the good mutant. The nanny makes a boy appear in the child's room, makes the latter disappear, creates an illusory universe to convince Guerin that an evil witch wants to take her child. She even manipulates Guerin's husband as well as Caroline Monroe. When they're no longer useful, she kills them or has them commit suicide. Hmm. Eventually, Guerin, who becomes aware of her powers, fights her evil counterpart in a delirium of optical effects. I don't know, does that sound like the film we just watched?
Only vaguely.
It
sounds like the movie we're talking about if you hadn't seen it in about 15 years.
Yeah. It's good stuff. There's lots of great imagery in here. Like, it's pretty full on in terms of the special effects. Apparently the film was never actually released in Italy because it was considered to be too gory.
Huh.
Which, given what we know about Italian cinema, seems a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, but really.
That is apparently the case. But it was a US co-production, so I think it did get released in the States.
Well, it was
obviously
picked
it was shot
up,
in English.
It was, so. Yeah, it was picked up during production by Menachem Golan's 21st Century Film Corporation. This was after Golan had left Canon Films and was producing films on his own. So he picked this up for release and was actually responsible for doing, you know, for initiating a few trims of the film before it was released.
And the whole black cat thing, presumably.
No. That was apparently... That wasn't him. The movie was already rolling, I think, by the time that came along. So it was actually some of the original producers that were involved in that bizarre aspect of this bizarre film.
Fair enough.
Unless Mr. Cozzi has some details he'd like to drop in our ear. By the way, I do have like a list of questions for him about the production of this film, and that's kind of one of them, which is, you know, he worked with he worked with Menachem Golan on the Hercules films, and so there's a history there, and I'm just kind of curious as to his impressions over that period of time and what it was like to work with him. But nevertheless, this movie it would be very easy. Let me preface it by saying this: the only way I'd ever seen this before was from a really crappy bootleg of, I think, a VHS tape from Japan. I'm not positive. I can't remember what the source material was, but it was a movie that when I first saw it, I enjoyed, but I also knew that this was a really crappy way to try to judge this thing. Now that we have the Severin Blu-ray, I have to say. My feelings about the movie have improved because you can see the damn thing. you can get a firm indication of what was going on visually in the movie, which I think is probably the best way to judge this thing, because the story is, how do I put this nicely? Typical Luigi Cozzi, you know, WTF cinema. It's where he has apparently got an end goal in sight. But the different pathways we get there are often just really silly. And honestly, all of the details are often things that you can see that he's just stealing from other movies. And he'll be the first to admit a lot of that theft. But it becomes a question of, and don't get me wrong, this is not a criticism of this film. This is something that actually enhances my enjoyment of it. But it becomes a question of just how many reference points from other things can you spot within this? And I almost wanted to start making a list, and then I realized, well, no, then I won't be able to watch the movie. So I'll just watch the film, make mental note of a couple of them. My favorite, beyond, and this is a non-visual one, which is probably why it's stuck in my head, which is there are several points in the movie where the score, the actual music produced for the film, is just flatly ripping off Ennio Morricone's score for Carpenter's The Thing. And then we have, you know, a bed of a synthesizer sound coming in underneath it. I'm just like, okay, that's exactly where that's coming from. So I know exactly what he told the musician. It's like, I wanted to sound like The Thing. But the other things that are buried within it, I mean, he's pulling things from all over the place, and the way he's structured this allows him to kind of throw images up on the wall and then later on completely negate them because they don't really matter. And especially with the ending, where we essentially just alter everything. No longer is the, you know, longer do we have, you know, the adulterous relationship. That's just wiped away and all these different things.
Yeah.
I enjoy it, but I mean, he steals the creepy little girl holding a ball from Kill Baby Kill, from Mario Bava. So, you know, don't get me wrong, he's swiping from the best, but.
Oh, wow. And they're all, and all people he knew personally.
Mm-hmm. Well, the little girl playing, you know, holding the glowing ball is apparently Kotze's daughter anyway. So,
there
you go. So, I'm giving the impression that this is a jumbled mess of a movie, and it kind of is. Yeah. But it also has so much going for it. Plus, it's a little under 90 minutes long, so it doesn't stick around long enough to really to really get on your nerves by any stretch.
And that is the correct length for a film,
especially a film of this type.
Just if all films could stick to that, the world would be a better place.
There are movies that can be longer than that, but we need to just make them as television series now, okay?
Yeah, or give them an intermission.
I am all for that.
So that I've been watching a lot of Bollywood movies in the last couple of years, and they are long, but they all have intermissions, even at the cinema, and it's so good.
Yes.
I don't know. We should all have Avatar, for example. Could really have benefited from an intermission.
Oh, and there's a film that I never intend to watch. So,
yeah, we went to see the new one, and it's like over 3 hours.
See, that's just it. I saw the original back when it came out, 2009, and I remember thinking for the last half of it, wow, this is a retread of 15 other films that I've seen before, dressed up with astonishingly wonderful special effects. So he really doesn't have any kind of new story to tell. And so I just sat there for the last half of the movie going, man, I hope he pulls something narratively interesting. And he never did. So it's like,
no,
I'm not sitting down for three more hours of that. Yeah. Thank you.
But, you know, you can have one Avatar or two Black Cats. So what you're going to do, the choice is obvious.
Even if I just watched the Black Cat twice in a row, I'd be okay with that.
Yeah.
I
mean, exactly.
Well, at any rate,
but anyway,
we're leaving out
the other ending,
couple, the screenwriter who's working on this film within a film. His wife is played by Caroline Monroe, and she's a lot of fun in this. She's
having a great time.
I mean, everything from seducing the director to vamping it up with her husband, and then we get the whole big bubble bath scene and this whole nine yards. I mean, there's just so much going on with her in this movie where it's very clear that Kotze's very happy to have her back in front of his camera again.
And she doesn't get to play the villain all that often.
No.
So it's kind of fun that she's getting to be evil Caroline in this film.
Right. And see, this is that period of time when she was remember, it had only been like a year before that she'd shot a movie with Paul Naschy. She'd done Howl of the Devil with him. And
She had such an... I've met Caroline Monroe loads of times back when I used to go to Hammer conventions. And all the Q&As and everything with her, they were only ever about Hammer movies. And occasionally maybe somebody would mention Ray Harryhausen. Yeah. But like when you look at what she's done, her period in the 80s was so interesting. She was, like you said, she's like all over Europe, making all kinds of crazy stuff, and no one ever really asked her about that. Like, you know, she was in a Jess Franco film as well.
Faceless,
like she's done so much interesting stuff, and then people would just always constantly ask her about Dracula.
Yeah, and it's like, which is fine. I think why several years ago when I got the chance to ask her some questions about Howl of the Devil, and then this movie as well. I think that's why she was, you know, her attitude, her body language changed considerably, because she already knew I was going to be asking her about Howl of the Devil, so she was ready for that. But when I mentioned this film, she says, "Oh my goodness, have you seen it?" Because at that point, this was like 10 years ago.
Yeah, it was lost.
Yeah, at
it?
This point, 10 years ago, she had never been able to see the film.
Yeah, people believed it was a kind of lost film for a long time. When Severin went to Kotze and said, "We want to put this out," he's like, "I think he said." have you found it? Because he hadn't even got it. Like, he didn't know where it was. Or so interesting. Which, again, so what we were saying before, the well is never going to be dry with this stuff. Just, if there are lost films like this can be found, then anything's possible.
And it's wonderful that, like I say, this is a crazy film. But if you're sitting down to watch this movie, mm-hmm. you already kind of know what ride you're in for. You know, you've paid your ticket to a certain degree. And so this is...
It's unlikely this will be your first cutscene.
Or if it is, you're going to kind of be lost.
If it is, where have you been?
Yeah. You're going to kind of wonder just what is this messy, meandering thing and be curious about it.
I wouldn't start here, that's for sure.
No, I wouldn't start with Paganini horror or this. You kind of need to dip your toes into the stuff that was made about a decade before that, at the very least. So
yeah, it's so fun.
Yeah. By the way,
there's a lot to enjoy.
There is a lot to enjoy. Were you shocked to have Brett Halsey pop up as a wheelchair-bound reclusive movie producer? I mean, it just seems like such a... This is during that period of time when Brett Halsey was, you know, making movies with Lucio Fulci, and he was popping up here and there in various Eurocult things. It's kind of amazing I often forget he's in this movie, and then when he pops up playing such an asshole character, I'm like, you know, this is a weird breath of fresh air in a way.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm not that familiar with him. I think he's much more prominent probably on American TV and stuff, so he wasn't somebody that I was that familiar with.
Oh, really? Okay.
If I'm honest. I mean, I've seen films that he's mm-hmm. in, but I know that he's in a lot of American television and stuff, like The Dukes of Hazzard and all kinds of fun
stuff. Well, yeah, he was a name to a certain degree in his heyday, and I think that's why he was such a good get for a lot of... for a lot of productions. I mean, he was the main character in the Return of the Fly, and he had a small role in Coppola's Godfather 3 and things like that. I mean, he did a lot of movies stretching all the way back into that, probably just the 50s. I don't think it goes back any further than that. And so, yeah, he did, you know, as his career was going on, by the 80s, he was doing a lot of television. If you saw American television in the 80s, Brett Halsey was going to pop up on an episode of, something. Well,
I'm just looking at his list. He was in an episode of Automan.
Oh, my God, really?
Which is that was a show that I loved back in the 80s, but no one else seemed to know what it was. It was like one of those shows that I thought I dreamt. But now, obviously, thanks to the internet, you can find anything.
I've never seen an episode of that. It's something I probably ought to check out.
But I was obsessed with Automan when it was on. I'm just getting distracted now because the trailer for Automan just started playing on the IMDb page. God. But yeah, so yeah, Brett Halsey, obviously, you know, so many actors like mm-hmm. him would turn up in Euro cinema, not imagining that years later people in America would actually see it.
Right. Right, especially the stuff he did for Fulci, where he as an actor, I mean, he shows in some of those Fulci films that he made for Italian television that he was more than willing to cross some really weird lines. I'll just leave it at that and let people discover those Fulci films with Brett Halsey.
Yeah, I did watch. I know he's in Demonia, which I watched recently. Which I have to confess, it was not my favorite Fulci.
But then
I'd be surprised if it was anyone's favorite.
None of those late 80s Fulci films are exactly what I would refer to as fantastic, but they are interesting to a degree.
Exactly.
You
know, it's
touch of death.
Always interesting. But anyway, yes. So, so what are your sort of final thoughts on The Black Cat then? And I know you had some questions. Do you want to just mention to us now what some of those are?
Oh, well, like I say, a lot of my questions involve the production, mainly because, and this kind of dovetails with Blood on Melies Moon as well, which is how hard was it for him to convince his fellow directors to just pop up on camera for him? Because like you say, we get Michele Soavi, who's early in his directorial career at this point, and he's more than willing to do, apparently, a cameo there at the beginning. Yeah. And then there's also, I'm very curious about his relationship with Menachem Golan. But specific to this movie, I'm also curious about how, I mean, because he's working different pieces of things into this that are direct references to earlier films of his. And I'm wondering if some of them are direct callbacks that he's wanting to make, or if they're just things, if they're just images that he's wanting to put on screen again. For instance, the alien contamination, or contamination, depending on which title he wants it to go by, the alien inspired, you know, chest and stomach bursting special effect, yeah, gets played again here.
Gets used here, yeah, yes.
And I'm wondering if if that's something he was doing because he'd done it before, or if he was doing it because, you know, for some specific reason relating to how he viewed this particular story. In other words, does he like the effect, or does the effect have a purpose within this story that doesn't have anything to do with a callback?
I should mention, actually, speaking of effects, that the effects supervisor, I believe, on this film was our friend Armando Valcauda again.
Yeah.
Who, of course, was responsible for the fantastic colorization of Godzilla about 10 years earlier. And I use fantastic in air quotes there. But I know I think, to be fair, he was responsible for the visual effects in this film rather than the practical effects. But yeah, because there's a lot of visual effects going on here as well. There's glowing red glowing mm-hmm. eyes and all kinds of stuff, as well as the more sort
there's a possessed refrigerator. So, you know, don't forget that. But, and by the way, that whole refrigerator thing, if you wanted to trim something.
Yeah, well. But it's under 90 minutes, isn't it?
But if you wanted to be 85, you could be.
Yeah.
But I got to say, I want to give massive praise that, you know, and this is not something I could have said earlier until this Blu-ray came out. The photography, is it Pascal Rachini? It's honestly, I love the look of the movie. This is back when we're still shooting on film, so it can have that really, there can be scenes with a lot of fog and some diffused lighting and things like that, and it still just looks fantastic. And there are lots of moments where he's clearly stealing from Bava for weird gel lighting and spots of green light here and there.
Oh, sure.
And it all looks really, really good. And also, I kind of enjoy the synth score of the movie from Vince Tempura, or Vince Tempera. Mm. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce his name. He was involved in a lot of movie scores from in the 70s and 80s. But I enjoy it even when it's clear that he's being instructed to at particular times steal from the thing. But the weirdest thing to me, is a question that I definitely have for Maestro Cozzi, which is, of course, this movie being an Italian horror film produced, even though he wants to call it a science fiction movie, let's be clear, it's not. it has those stabs of heavy metal music that are on the soundtrack as well. It comes stinging in there, songs from Bang Tango and White Lion. And I'm very curious as to whether or not he chose those songs specifically, or if they were kind of forced upon him. I'm very curious as to the song choices and whether or not those were, how they got chosen to be in the film. Because I have to admit that as the film opens with a particular Bang Tango song, it does actually feel like we're watching. It feels very natural. But then, of course, later in the film, when some of it kind of bleeds in, it does have that unnatural "what the hell are we doing here" feeling that kind of pushes you away from the image and that you run across in things like the Demons films and things like that, where you're just like, well, we're just shoving a Judas Priest song into this now. What the hell are we doing here? So, like I say, there are lots of questions of that type that I would have about it. But once again, just being able to finally see this in high def has made me like this movie more. I always kind of felt it was a very interesting production, something that I enjoyed but thought of as kind of the bastard child of a bunch of different things that doesn't really add up to much. And honestly, I don't know that I would necessarily change that description of it at all. I would just add the codicil, and I really love it. So,
yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, I mean, we don't come to these films for the tight plotting and narrative structure. No. And yeah, The Black Cat is definitely a film that delivers, I would say. Speaking of which, and just got a few minutes left, let's segue into something that... This was Kotze's last feature film.
Until?
But then he surprised everybody by bouncing back a good 25-something years later. Because it was around 1989 when he opened the Profondo Rosso store in Rome. And that seemed to kind of take up most of his time. He started going to lots of festivals, and he's a judge at all kinds of film festivals and things like that. And he also made some documentaries. He made a documentary about Dario Argento. But primarily it was the Profondo Rosso store and its publishing arm as well, publishing lots of books on cinema, many of which he wrote himself. So that seemed to be his kind of early retirement from film directing. He got out rather than having to spend the rest of his career making episodes of Italian television, which seems to be where a lot of other Italian directors ended up. He's sort of stepped away. But then, 25 years later, he surprises everybody by announcing that he's made a film called Blood on Méliès' Moon. Mm-hmm. And this was a project that originated back in his Canon days. Actually, he proposed this film. He had an idea to do it as a film set in the era of Méliès, and he proposed this to Canon, and it was just going to be too much money, and they weren't really interested and wanted him to make Hercules instead, I think, or possibly Hercules 2. I forget exactly where it fitted in, but it was around that time. But he filed it away, and then he decides to make it himself as a contemporary film. But not only did he decide to make it, he decided to star in it as well. And came up with this film that is kind of defies description. But I did ask you to watch it, ready for us to talk about it. And I don't want us to then take another hour going into it, because we've kind of, we've exhausted ourselves on The Black Cat. But just... what are your thoughts on this film? I don't know whether it's even possible to describe the basic plot, but we can have a go. But just initially, what did you think when you saw it?
Okay, let's be ridiculous. Be kind. I'm going to be blunt about one thing right off the top. It is easily 30 minutes too long, because it's two hours long.
Yeah, this is a film that could have also been 90 minutes
by a long shot. It needed scissors attached to the, to the print really, really fast.
That's true.
But I will say that I had learned as little as I could about this film before watching it, because I think we've all been in the position, if we're longtime movie fans, of watching a beloved filmmaker return behind the camera, and inevitably the... it's shocking if the return behind the camera after years of not being in the industry is something impressive. So it was not something that I did not expect this movie to kind of be a return to the joys of the stuff that he produced in the 1980s or the 70s. But I did not realize that this was going to be essentially him taking on, you know, the idea of that Fulci and Fulci had done with Cat in the Brain, and essentially placing himself front and center as a main character.
Yeah.
And he didn't even have the smarts to do what was done in New Nightmare, where the director is in the movie as himself, but is very much a secondary character, only in a couple of scenes.
No, he's at the whole thing.
Right. He is front and center in roughly, I would say, 70% of this picture. And credit where credit's due. He doesn't embarrass himself. He's not awful, which is exactly what I was expecting. But at the same time, I don't know that it's good to advertise as the movie goes on that essentially you shot this at home and at work.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that must be his own house.
It's got to be.
And he's got... I tell you what, I became obsessed with his quilt cover. He's got this fabulous bedding set that is all stars, and now I really want one of those.
Yeah.
And yeah, we get to see Luigi in his pajamas at home. Yeah,
not a sight that I signed up for, but you know, okay.
And like you said, yeah, and a lot of it is shot in the Profondo Rosso store.
And the museum underneath.
So, in the museum in the sort of wine cellar basement. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, if you've never been there, it's quite a fun way to be introduced to it. But then he also goes to Paris, to be fair. There's some location work.
I got to say, I was taking notes as I was watching along and thinking to myself, okay, he's essentially kind of merging some giallo elements with science fiction, and then merging both of those with a lot of bizarre fantasy stuff. There's long stretches where I got really interested in the larger story that he's trying to tell about the origins of cinema itself, and the idea of images that are looking, you know, images that we're looking at that are returning that gaze, that are essentially looking back at us. That I found a very interesting concept, but where he goes with it isn't, I mean, honestly, it's such an interesting idea. No matter what you do, once you, you know, nail it down into something concrete, it almost always feels less impressive than it could be. And of course, that's certainly true here. And he goes out of his way. He's got so much screen time that he's trying to tie everything into this. And I do love the idea of having science fictional events like UFOs or the concept of aliens appearing instead as supernatural events. You know, the whole idea of, you know, if technology is advanced, you know, far enough, then it will appear to as magic to someone unaware of the fact that it's technology. That's interesting, but it's only vaguely played with before he starts trying to tie in, you know, tarot cards and mysterious books of forbidden knowledge. And of course, that's kind of the jumping off point. It kind of brackets everything where we have this book called the Vagabond Universe, this supposedly French
French sci-fi novel that somehow connected to Méliès, but also the sort of mystery around Louis Le Prince, the guy that really did allegedly invent cinema, but then mysteriously disappeared on a train back in 1892, and then it's all sort of tied up with French magicians and
demon possession, satanic rites, other dimensions, Earth crashing into Earth,
giant teddy bears. He has a nightmare where somebody's telling him that he's the Italian Ed Wood. That's really funny. And he wakes up like, I'm not the Italian
Ed Wood.
And
then, without ever getting out of bed,
he starts to think, actually,
comes around to thinking
Edward was famous.
A good
thing. Yes. Yeah, Edward was famous. Tim Burton might come to Italy and make a film about
him. Exactly. It's just like, you just want to look and see if you could spot where the used LSD tab is next to him on the bed. You know?
Yeah, this film is like a real insight into his sense of humor.
Yes, this is true.
Because he's so funny. And it is very funny. But there's also lots of cameos. He goes around Lamberto Barber's house for dinner, which is quite fun. And they talk about Mario Barber's sci-fi library, which I don't know if that was a real thing or just made up for the film. I like to think that
it would be interesting if that was a real thing, but I don't know if it was.
Yeah. There's also a brief cameo. I say cameo, it's not really a cameo. Dario Argento is in here, but only because he was doing a book signing
at the
Profondo Rosso store.
It's just stolen footage of him doing a book signing.
Yeah, they just shot some footage of that. That's got nothing to do with the film at all. But also Barbara Mandolfi is in here, the Italian actress who was in Suspiria.
True.
And a bunch of other stuff. She pops up in here. So there's some, it's quite interesting what's going on. But the plot, makes no sense at all. But again, doesn't really matter, just does it.
There are stretches. There really are stretches of this movie. Like the whole bit when they start digging into the whole charity event that happened in Paris in 1897, where there was a fire where 100 people died, and we have this magician that was burned, and afterwards this masked magician popped up doing an act, the question is whether that it's like that whole little segment is like, wow, that would be a really interesting movie if you expanded that out and did something with it. But here it's just jumbled in with other stuff, combined with all these other weird ideas, and it's It's strange. I mean, well, by the time we got down to, you know, some character in the past who was apparently an alchemist working with, you know, the idea of reflected light, and it was just and then there became whole big chunks of it where I was just distracted by the fact that for some reason Luigi Cozzi wants to wear a bow tie all the time. I don't understand it.
Oh, I know. That was so funny.
I don't get it. It's odd, and I'm willing to roll, but okay, sure.
There's a weird bit where he's in his house and he just walks in wearing a giant bear costume.
I know, just to mess with his wife.
Talks to his wife, yeah, which I think was his real wife. I've met her in the shop. I'm pretty sure that was her. So again, this is totally like just a family home movie.
Well, I have to admit, if it is really his wife, she plays exasperation very well.
Yes, I'm sure there was little acting involved. She's just like, oh, not again. So in the introduction to the film on the Blu-ray, he talks about how the sort of the origin of the film, and I mean, basically, they were to a certain degree making it up as they went along. Like they would just do it in, they would sort of write and then film bits of it at a time. And that's why I think it feels more like a series of different bits rather than having a coherent narrative. But, you know, like we said with the Black Cat, that's not necessarily the reason we're here. Yeah. So, but there's lots of fun. I did laugh a lot in this. And Cozzi, like you said, you know, with the whole big bow tie and everything, it's like he's just really hamming it up. And I think this does reveal a lot about his sense of humor, which I hadn't really quite got before. Maybe just, I don't know. I didn't think of Cozzi as a funny guy, but he clearly is.
What this movie does, what Blood on Melies Moon did for me as an appreciator of Cozzi's entire career, is it really finally kind of rubbed my nose in an idea that has been lurking around in the back of my head for a long period of time, and I'm glad to finally give it voice, which is that to a large degree, one of the reasons why I enjoy his work so much is, like some other filmmakers that I can think of, like Guillermo del Toro, their obsessions and their fascinations I share to a large degree. I am also very, very, very interested in almost everything that fascinates Luigi Cozzi. Science fiction and old movies and monster movies and all the things that he jumbles together into this movie, and in The Black Cat to some degree as well. All of these things are things that I love too. Pulp novels and weird books and all these different things, they're all interests of mine as well. I've always said that when I have the most fun with Jess Franco movies is when his love of pulp fiction, when his love of weird stories starts, you know, is like the jumping off point for one of his features. That's when I feel a real kindred spirit for Jess Franco.
Yeah.
And now I realize that it's the same thing with Luigi Cozzi. It's just that Luigi really has I don't know if it's the fear I'm never going to get to make another film again, so I'm going to throw everything into this one, or if it's just that he has ADD and is completely unable to focus and realize that this 2-hour movie could have been an 80 or 85 minute sharply focused thing where he retained all of the most interesting bits that are in this, and it would have been really, really, really good, as opposed to by the end of it, I'm just glad the credits are finally rolling, because it's like, my God, there's too much in this damn movie.
Yes, that's fair. He does throw absolutely everything at the wall.
Yeah, and I understand. Like I said, whether it's fear of I'm not going to get to do this again, or just the joy, the sheer joy of being able to throw it up on screen and point to it and go, don't you enjoy this too? And it's like, yeah, I do. Make it shorter.
I think the look on his face when he's flying through space in Méliès's rocket.
Yes.
And he's just looking out the window. The look on his, the silly look on his face, I think says it all.
And it shifts into silent movie intertitles and.
Yeah, and his hats keep changing. And like just the look of sheer joy on his face, I think says everything we need to know about Luigi Cozzi.
And it's like this film Blood on Melies Moon makes me both love him more, and want to smack him harder. It's like.
Just give him a big pair of shears.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you have to. There comes a point when you just want to whisper in his ear. You've really got to think of your audience, man. You really kind of need to think about the people sitting in the seats. Okay.
Yeah.
But I have to admit, though, that's the first time this movie, Blood on Melia's Moon, is the first time I've ever thought that he did not understand the need to get to a point, if not the point, you know?
It's probably the first one that's over 90 minutes as well.
Yeah.
And it's probably because he didn't have a producer and a budget or anything like that. He's just doing this as he could afford it and just making it with his mates. So he didn't have anyone telling him to rein it in or cut some pages or anything like that, which, you know, so he's unleashed in this film for better and for worse.
Yeah.
I suppose you could say. But it's good fun. So I'm going to talk to him about it in the interview, but he's made a couple more films since then. So obviously there's Little Wizards of Oz 1. He's also made one called The Battle of Rome, 1849, which I haven't seen, and I don't know if that's available or what, so I'll ask him about that. But he's clearly not giving up. Like, he's, you know, I think now he's discovered digital video, he's just going to keep going. He's also just recently made a new documentary about Dario Argento and the museum. I think the museum is it's about the Dario Argento museum itself. So he's not retiring, which is quite fun, and the fact that he's willing to come on a little podcast like this one, I think also just shows how much he likes to talk about this stuff.
Well, I think that he is very much like us. He very much does just love this stuff, and the chance to of course, you know, talk about his own stuff, but also it is a joy to sometimes see him in interviews talking about how much he loves, you know, other things as well, you know, cinema of the past, and the things that inspired him and the things that he loved when he was a child and that he still takes joy from. So,
yeah. So with that said, I'll be interviewing Luigi in about 2 weeks' time. So if you have any questions you would like me to put to him, please do send them to us. You can find us, all our contact details are on the show notes. We've got email, we've got Twitter, we've got Instagram. So please do get in touch with us if you want to, you know, just to let us know what you think of the show, but especially at the moment, you know, what are your thoughts about Luigi Cozzi? I'd love to know, and if there's anything that you'd like us to talk about with him, then we can give it a go. I am going to send him some questions in advance because, I mean, his English is pretty good, but still, I thought I'd give him a fighting chance by letting him know sort of in advance what we're planning to do.
Yeah.
I think that's all we've got for today and for this season. Do get in touch with us. We'd love hearing from you. I also wanted to mention, you can, if you want to, you can support us by buying us a virtual coffee. That's KOFI. And you can find the contact details for that as well and the link on the show notes. I would like to just actually, I have to confess, I keep forgetting to mention this, but we have had a couple of people who have bought us coffees, and I wanted to give them shout outs on the show. A guy called Michael Iacarino, thank you very much, Michael, for your support. And also Kurt, no surname on Kurt, but Kurt and Michael have both bought us virtual coffees. So Rod, next time I see you, I will buy you a coffee in real life to pass that.
I would prefer hot tea, but okay, that's fine.
Okay, well, I'll have a hot chocolate. Well, but neither of us will have coffee. But anyway, thank you so much, guys, for your support, and we do appreciate anyone who wants to support us. I'm going to try this year to sort of get the podcast growing a bit more, and I'll try and, you know, there are various ways we can do that. But your support will make that more possible.
Are we finally going to, is 2023 the year we finally sell out? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, maybe. I mean, I have already sold out. So some of you may already, I don't know if you're annoyed by this or not. Let us know. Give us some feedback. But there are ads on the podcast. So if that's really annoying, let me know what you think. But, I'm just trying things here. I'd love to get the podcast to grow, not so that I can make some money and retire early.
No.
That's never been my motivation at all.
Or a possibility, to be honest.
But it would be nice. it's never going to happen. But just anything that we can do to try and help the podcast to find a bigger audience. I think that's the goal, isn't it?
So, yes.
Anyway, so thank you to you guys and anyone else who wants to support us with that. So we will be back with a new season in 2 or 3 weeks, where we are going to start looking at Italy's post-apocalypse movies. So that is going to be some leather-studded fun.
Lots of dangerous motorcycle stunts, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm gonna start customizing my car now. Ooh. So that I'm ready, covering it in spikes, and definitely we'll be ready to go.
Definitely spikes and a flamethrower. I want a flamethrower on top of my car. I've been thinking about that for years. Yeah.
Now is the time. Anyway, so thanks everybody for listening. Thank you again, Rod, for doing this.
Glad to do it.
As ever. And we will be back with another podcast episode soon. Bye for now.
Bye, everyone.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at Ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.